Well, thank you very much. I'm absolutely stunned, honestly. I thought there may be max 100 people or something, but this is incredible. It's a great pleasure to be here. I was here 15 years ago, and I don't remember very much except your market, and it was wonderful just to walk around the town today. And I don't travel enough, unfortunately, to the West Coast, but I hope that will be rectified in the years to come. It's a great pleasure to be here. I was in Kabul about a week, 10 days ago, and I'm coming back from there, and I'm very happy to take questions later on Pakistan, Afghanistan, Central Asia, whatever else you may like. But I will, I'll start with Central Asia, and then I've been told that, you'd be interested to hear about, what I think about what's going on in Afghanistan. So I'll end with something on Afghanistan. Let me just, the Taliban book was really written as much as an informative book, as much as a warning to people that if you ignore Afghanistan long enough, Afghanistan is going to, is going to create major destabilization in the region. Unfortunately, that came true. The new book on Central Asia is equally a warning that the Central Asian regimes are in deep crisis, that there is the enormous potential for social and economic unrest in Central Asia, which can also create global instability, because Central Asia is sandwiched between Russia and China. It borders South Asia and Afghanistan, and of course now the Americans are in Central Asia, which complicates the issue even more and really has brought it onto the world stage. Very briefly, as the professor said, the Soviets ruled Central Asia for 70 years, and their rule was really, marked by two or three, quick things which I'll come up with. The first was that Central Asia was an amalgam of principalities, tribes, clans, nomads, and the Soviets created basically five ethnic groups amongst them, and gave them, built Soviet socialist republics around them, and which are today the modern states of Central Asia, but creating huge ethnic problems which are remaining. There are 100 ethnic groups in Central Asia, and the Soviets did not really resolve the problem. In fact, they complicated it. Secondly, they gave these ethnic groups a version of history, a Sovietized version of history, which completely distorted their own history, their tradition, their culture. And thirdly, they repressed Islam, and Islam was very much part of their culture and tradition and history. And, if you not only was it a kind of religious repression, but it was a repression of, many other kinds, which really affected how they saw their past and how they would see their future once the Soviet Union broke up in 1991. The other problem that they had was that the Russian Soviets, if you like, the white Russians, were never able to really create an indigenous local communist elite until very late in the day, until the 1950s. And the elite that they did create was an incredibly, an elite that just owed everything to Moscow. And that particular leadership that came up, in the 70s and 80s is still with us today. It's 10 years after independence. And what has been significant after 1991 and the creation of the five independent republics has been that there's been no leadership change in Central Asia for 10 years. Now, in 1991, Central Asia gets independence, and really, these elites were, these Sovietized elites, were cut off from, the mother country, Russia, as it were, their markets, their whole, being and grasp on power and the intelligence, the military, their foreign policy was, of course, run from Moscow. And they were suddenly bereft of all this, and they were faced with having to cope, with life on their own, as it were. And there was really, two possibilities, which was faced by all the former Soviet republics. Either you open yourself up to the outside world, you open your societies up, you carry out reforms, or you carry on as before and you keep a closed society. And unfortunately, the regimes in Central Asia basically shut themselves up and refused to carry out any kind of effective economic or political reform. So unlike the Baltic republics and even Russia now in the mid-90s, there's been very little economic reform and even less political reform. When I say economic reform, I mean none of the kind of steps towards a market economy, towards privatization, towards land reform, getting rid of the communes, etc., were carried out. And what has resulted is a kind of crony capitalism, where whatever benefits were carried out, economically speaking, benefited the president and the families and the party structure around him. As far as political reform, that was even less. There was a huge flowering, if you like, of democracy in 1991 for about a year, where you had secular nationalist, secular parties, democratic parties, nationalist parties, all kinds of parties sort of bubbled up to the surface. Human rights groups, NGOs, a lot of, you know, there was a lot of political activity copying what was happening in Russia and the other republics. But within a year, almost, you know, in a blanket form, all these groups basically disappeared because the government suppressed them, except for one state, Kyrgyzstan, in which there was some kind of, you know, political and media freedom. So in Central Asia, simply the democratic opposition, the you know, nationalist opposition, intellectuals, people who were trying to grasp the new opportunity that was being presented them and were trying to articulate in which direction these states should lead, were basically suppressed. Now, at the same time that this was happening, there was an enormous Islamic revival in 91. And this was very much part of the sort of the global Islamic revival as a result of the defeat of the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, and an Islamic revival which came up, I think, all around the world, in North Africa, in the Middle East, in South Asia. But in Central Asia, it was a particular poignance, because 70 years, you know, of repression, people were allowed to pray, and people were allowed to learn about the religion, and people were allowed to connect the religion to their past history. Here too, unfortunately, what happens is that Central Asia was considered by many Islamic parties in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, in the Middle East, as kind of virgin territory. That here were these, you know, this huge Muslim population of 50 million people who were complete novices on Islam. And many of these parties went into Central Asia, not with the kind of goodwill, if you like, of trying to educate these people about their traditions and culture, but basically to recruit them to their own particular cause, which was basically an interpretation of Islam, a radical Islam, and they saw Central Asia as this kind of virgin territory which they could convert. They brought in money, they built up mosques, they built up, you know, radical groups. So there was an enormous import of what I call, you know, this imported ideology, which had very little to do with the traditional Islam of Central Asia. And the traditional Islam of Central Asia is basically a moderate form of Islam, because Central Asia historically was the birthplace of Sufism, the spiritual and mystical side of Islam. All the major, you know, most of the major Sufi saints are buried in Central Asia. It was the second most important place of pilgrimage for Muslims after, you know, Makkah and Medina and Saudi Arabia. And of course, the Central Asian people had been cut off from this tradition for 70 years, and they were never really allowed, either by the regimes or by, you know, the Sufi sects and their organizations, to go back to this tradition. And what came in was instead these kind of imported ideologies. Now, I outline many of the radical Islamic groups that have come to the forefront in Central Asia. But the most important thing was that they had created links with Afghanistan, with the Taliban, subsequently with Osama bin Laden, with radical groups in Pakistan, with the Wahhabi, if you like, the state religion of Saudi Arabia. A lot of Wahhabi foundations, a lot of the royal princes in Saudi Arabia funded these radical groups, because the Saudis and a lot of the Gulf states failed really to build state-to-state relations with the Central Asian regimes, and instead wanted to promote Wahhabism and their particular interpretation of Islam in Central Asia. So through a process of radicalization, what you get is suppression of these radical groups by the regimes, and then a lot of these radical groups fleeing to Afghanistan, to Pakistan, and taking up residence there. And once they get linked up with the Taliban and Osama bin Laden, they of course become highly radicalized, and even in many shapes and forms change their ideologies. What bin Laden was talking about was a global jihad, against the regime, against the Muslim regimes, and against the Americans. So you have a group, for example, like the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, which had a local agenda, which was basically to try and topple the regime in Uzbekistan, comes to Afghanistan, comes under the influence of bin Laden, is funded and supported by bin Laden, and then you see the IMU taking on a kind of a pan-Islamic ideology, which was not just restricted now to Uzbekistan, but they wanted to topple all the regimes of Central Asia. They enlist Chechens from the Caucasus, they enlist Russian Muslims, and they enlist even Muslims from China. And then they embark on a kind of a policy of creating an Islamic Turkestan. Turkestan was the old word for Central Asia, and which would include not just the Central Asian states, but also Muslim China and Muslim parts of Russia. So these influences have created a major impact on these foreign influences have created a major impact on the radicalization of Islamic movements in Central Asia. But essentially, what I try to do in this book is to really, weigh up that where do you put the blame? Where do you put the onus? I mean, do you put it on the regimes for the lack of, for their repression and for their lack of reform, or do you put it on the militant groups? And I put the onus very clearly on the regimes. The regimes were unable to reform. They were unable to offer a democratic alternative. They suppressed not only these radical groups, but countries like Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan actually suppressed Islam. I mean, if you had a beard, if you covered your head, if you went to the mosque 5 times a day, you were immediately suspect in the eyes of these regimes. Uzbekistan today has something like 7,000 political prisoners, the second largest group of political prisoners in the world after China. Turkmenistan is much the same. And unfortunately what happened was that, the democratic opposition basically fled to Russia, fled to Moscow. Moscow became the kind of Miami of, democratic opposition, for Central Asia. And if the Russians supported you, if you did their bidding, you were allowed to set up shop in Moscow, and you were allowed to, propagate your views against the regime back home in Central Asia. What is very interesting right now, and what I think has exacerbated the crisis in Central Asia, has been that these elites have now split, in the sense that the ruling elite has itself divided. So in Moscow today, for example, you have the former foreign minister of Turkmenistan, who's leading the opposition against the present regime in Turkmenistan. You have a former prime minister in Kazakhstan, who's leading the opposition in Kazakhstan. So within the elites now, more intelligent members of the elites have realized that, what our regimes have been doing is leading to an absolute crisis. So there is now a break, in this. Now, come 9/11, you have suddenly after, and Central Asia at that time also was very much, isolated. It was not part of the, it was not on the international stage. And because of the lack of reform, there was very little investment, except in two states, Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan, where there are enormous oil and gas resources, and which attracted American oil companies and European oil companies. Come 9/11, Central Asia comes center stage. There's the immediate negotiations start between the Americans and the Central Asian regimes for military bases. And today you have three military bases. You have military bases in Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Uzbekistan. So for the first time, if you like, Western armies, for the first time actually since Alexander the Great in 327 BC, for the first time you have a Western military presence in Central Asia, which of course has done, which has completely altered the balance of power in Central Asia, and portends a great I wouldn't say instability, but portends a clash of interest between three big powers in Central Asia. The Russians, who have considered Central Asia as their backyard for the last 200 years and are very weary and suspicious of American intentions in Central Asia. The Chinese, who have built up enormous trade, business, political influence in Central Asia and view the Americans with equal suspicion. The kind of Chinese paranoia about the Americans encircling China from Tibet, from India, and now from Central Asia, as it were. For the moment, things are quiet because it suits everyone to defeat the Taliban, to defeat Al-Qaeda. But in the future, this will be a source of friction, which could lead to very much a new kind of great game in Central Asia. But most importantly, I think, U.S. strategy has to create some kind of pressure on these regimes to reform. If the Americans are seen as the aiders and abettors of dictatorial regimes in Central Asia, I think it's going to create a new crisis for American strategy. Unfortunately, what I've seen or what we've seen in the last 6 months is simply a military-run policy where the Americans want the bases and the Americans are not necessarily putting the kind of pressure on these Central Asian regimes that, look, I mean, we're here... We are willing to provide aid and mobilize the World Bank and other international organizations to help you reform, but you have to carry out reform. For example, this year Uzbekistan, the Americans are providing Uzbekistan with $160 million worth of aid. Now, it's very clear that, if the Americans do not link this to some kind of conditionality, some kind of timetable for reform, starting with major economic reforms, the Americans are very quickly going to be seen by the people in Central Asia as friends of our local dictator, our local dictatorial regime, and not the friends of the Central Asian people. And I think that's incredibly important right now because let me tell you, Central Asia is one of the few areas of the Muslim world where actually there's very little perception of America. The Central Asians have been so isolated that there's no particularly strong anti-American feeling right now. People don't know what America is. I mean, people have, there's not even satellite TV and, or a free press. So people are not even aware of American culture or movies or TV or anything else. And there's no real perception of America. So there's a lot of curiosity about America. And if America is seen to come in, as it were, to give these regimes a carte blanche to carry on as they were doing before, it's going to be disastrous for America, American policy in Central Asia, because it's simply going to, first of all, turn eventually much of the population against the United States, and secondly, it's going to give these militant groups in Central Asia the excuse that they want to mobilize a new campaign against the regimes based on anti-Americanism, which is going to be something very new in Central Asia. Now, I think absolutely critical how American strategy evolves in Central Asia, times ahead and the months ahead. At the moment, I must say, over the last 4 months, there's very little indication that the Americans have any other kind of multi-dimensional strategic political policy. I feel very strongly, unfortunately, that the policy is being run almost, one-dimensionally by the military rather than being run multi-dimensionally by other parts of the U.S. government. Now, let me come, to Afghanistan. And I think, this is part of the problems right now in Afghanistan. Now, contrary to what, the Secretary of Defense keeps repeating every 2 or 3 days, Donald Rumsfeld, that the war is going on, that there's, a huge kind of conflict and all the rest of it. I would like to say that the war in Afghanistan is over now. There is a mopping up operation which is going on in 2 or 3 provinces out of 32 provinces in the country. in eastern Afghanistan. And that mopping up operation will carry on maybe for many, many months, and certainly it will require American troops and an American military presence in Afghanistan. But essentially, the war is over. I was in Kabul when this last operation, Operation Anaconda, was going on. And if you were watching the American media, you would think that there was this huge conflict, you know, going on the ground. Essentially, Operation Anaconda was going on in 10 square miles of Afghan territory. Now, it was very important because you had American troops on the ground for the first time, and they were doing a lot of the fighting, and of course the Americans took casualties also. But the fact of the matter is that the war was, you know, not affecting 95% of the Afghan population, who are waiting for other things, reconstruction, aid, a political process. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda are regrouping. I mean, today there was a big yesterday there was a big press conference saying the Taliban, but yes, they're regrouping. They're regrouping in very small areas on the border with Pakistan, and they're crossing and recrossing between Pakistan and Afghanistan, but they're not regrouping in the whole of Afghanistan. There's absolutely no threat that the Taliban are going to be able to reconquer Afghanistan or unsettle the interim government or unsettle anyone else in the rest of Afghanistan. So I think, you know, what people in Afghanistan want is basically security and aid and reconstruction, which can then generate a political process in the country. And that political process is taking place, hopefully in June, when the Loya Jirga, the Grand Tribal Council, meets. Something like 800 to 1,000 representatives of, you know, the population are going to meet and decide upon a new government, a new head of state, a new head of government, set up a constitutional committee, set up committees to rebuild the civil service, the judiciary, decide on many crucial elements. Now, it's absolutely critical that this political process takes place. But this political process cannot take place unless two things happen simultaneously. One is the is security, and the other is, you know, foreign aid and money comes. Now, if I can just go back to what was agreed at Bonn in December, you know, the Bonn Agreement, which set up the interim government, which established the you know, the present government of Hamid Karzai. Essentially, you know, Bonn was a partnership. It was a partnership between the international community on one hand and the Afghan interim government. And both obligated themselves to do certain things. And clearly this process in Afghanistan is not going to work unless both sides do what they committed themselves to do. The first thing that the international community committed itself to do was to help the interim government set up security and stability in Afghanistan. And that needed the presence of foreign troops, not just in Kabul, where they are now, but also in five, you know, four or five of the other major cities. What we have now is a situation where you've got 5,000 British-led troops in Kabul. But the US has basically said no to an expansion of foreign troops to be based in five other cities. Now, the US reason for that is that this will interfere with the war effort, you know, but the war is not going on in northern Afghanistan. It's not going on in western Afghanistan either. It's going on in a very limited area. And essentially, because the US is leading the war effort, and because the US has, you know, has so much now clout, really, over the, you know, the rest of the world in deciding policy, the Europeans, other Muslim countries who have wanted to play a role in expanding the security forces to the other cities have basically, you know, stepped back and said, well, until the US gives the go-ahead, we really can't do it. And this has been incredibly depressing. Hamid Karzai has been touring the world, you know, telling everyone who will listen to him that, you know, I need, you know, Western security forces. Now, nobody's saying that the US should be doing that. The US is fighting a war. That's fine. But the Europeans, other countries, you know, the present security force in Kabul is made up of 19 countries. Now, you know, each of these countries could and would, I think, expand into other cities. But it's not happening. The second major problem is that there was $4.5 billion pledged at the Tokyo conference for the reconstruction of Afghanistan. I can tell you none of that money has reached Kabul. Absolutely. So, you know, 3 months later, none of that money. There's been an incredible slowness of the international community in bringing that money to Kabul, in starting a reconstruction process. Now, reconstruction is not, you know, I mean, not even the rubble in Kabul has been cleared yet. Basically, you know. Yes, humanitarian aid is going on, people are being fed in the worst hit areas, but, you know, aid and reconstruction, development and reconstruction has not started. Now, that is intimately linked to dealing with the political process. You have warlords in outside Kabul, in other provinces, who are influential, who are powerful. Now, one thing that would diminish their power would be, you know, economic aid and reconstruction. Because a lot of their soldiers would then start going home simply. You know, if you could give these soldiers who haven't been paid for 6 months, who are fed up with the war, who are fed up with the fighting, if you could give them, you know, input, farmers to send them back home with seed, with fertilizer, with, you know, all the normal means of aid and development, you would be diminishing these warlords' powers. You have now a new poppy crop that has been grown, for opium production in the south of the country. Farmers have nothing, you know, they have no other seed except poppy. It's a very complicated situation, but essentially everything is tied in with everything else. You know, you cannot, you know, security would also diminish the warlords. Security would enhance the writ of the central government. Aid and reconstruction would diminish the warlords. It would allow you to start demobilizing, you know, these armed men who are all over the country. So, and everything, you know, security and aid would also allow you to set in process the indirect elections which are needed for membership of the Loya Jirga. So, what simply is needed in Afghanistan right now is a multi-dimensional policy, which is run not just by the Pentagon and by the, you know, by the Defense Department, but what is being run, what should be run by the State Department, by the agent, you know, the USAID, the Agency for International Development, which has a budget for $300 million for reconstruction, but can't spend that budget at the moment. And so what I'm trying to suggest here is that you need other elements of the US government in the decision-making process. And that's not happening. Essentially, the same people are taking decisions about Afghanistan and Central Asia who were taking the decisions in October. Now, that's fine. I mean, in October, that was fine. You had a war on. You know, there was an emergency crisis situation. But here now, it's a different ballgame. There's a political ballgame. There's an aid ballgame. There's a whole kind of, you know, development process which needs to be talked about in Central Asia, Afghanistan, and even in Pakistan. But unfortunately, at the moment, that's not happening. Now, let me just say, you know, a few other things, and why I think it is so important for the US to have a more balanced and a more structured and a more multidimensional approach to the present problems in Afghanistan. First of all, I think Afghanistan is a test case, if you like, for the US commitment, for involvement in the Muslim world right now. Now, given the Bush, you know, the Bush administration's past record of trying to, if you like, for the first 6 months of its term, pulling out of a lot of, you know, multilateral treaties, trying to pull out of kind of world affairs, as it were, and then being yanked back into the world because of 9/11, it's incredibly important that the U.S. and secondly, because of the U.S. reputation in the region, which is the reputation simply is that the United States has no commitment, that it will not rebuild. You know, the U.S. has a reputation in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, essentially that, you know, the U.S. will come in for 15 minutes, do their thing, and then walk away again. The U.S. abandoned Afghanistan in 1989 after the Soviets were withdrawn. The Pakistanis feel that the U.S. came in 3 times, you know, befriended Pakistan, and then walked away from Pakistan. So I think it's very important that the U.S. maintains a commitment in Afghanistan, which is not just a military commitment of, you know, knocking off Al-Qaeda and Taliban, but shows the whole Muslim world that it is interested in rebuilding and stabilizing a country which is critical to the stability of the Muslim world. Because, you know, this was the home of, you know, bin Laden and Taliban and terrorism and all the rest of it. And clearly a military policy in Afghanistan is not sufficient. Because, you know, if you abandon Afghanistan once again, in 5 years we're going to be back to poppy, drugs, terrorism, you know, and all the rest of the evils which were prevalent in Afghanistan over the last 10 years. So I think it's very important that the US, and I would simply say, with the Arab summit going on, I mean, many Arab nations have criticized Bush for, first of all, ignoring the Middle East for the last, 6 to 9 months before 9/11, now suddenly trying to rush back and trying to play a role. But essentially, you have now an American commitment to try and restore, to try and mediate in the Middle East. But I would not lessen the American commitment to Afghanistan, in my opinion, is almost as important in the wider context of the Muslim world, to show a U.S. Commitment in a very unstable part of the Muslim world. Now, I think this also has a very important impact for another issue. And the other issue is simply, I'm not one of those who say, the U.S. is to blame for everything, all this militancy and it doesn't understand Islam and all the rest of it. I put the blame very heavily on our own regimes. I mean, Muslim regimes have failed to reform, have failed to understand what has been going on in the world since the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1991. Muslim regimes have failed to democratize. They failed to carry out economic reform. They failed to join the global community in this new world that emerged after 1991. The end of the Cold War kicked away so many props that many Muslim regimes were dependent on. You were either, an American ally or you were a Soviet ally. You were getting aid from one, and suddenly all these props disappeared. And it was necessary then that you could not carry on the way you've been carrying on for the last 20, 30 years after the end of the colonial era, after the end of the Second World War. There was definitely a need that you could not, fool your population and fail to deliver the goods to your population, economically, politically, in human rights, in every other shape and form. So it is very important, and I think 9/11 has been a wake-up call to many Muslim regimes, to countries like Pakistan, where the military has been supporting the Taliban for 6 years. Now, thank God, you have people in Pakistan, you have the mainstream media now asking questions. I mean, what the hell were we doing for 6 years supporting the Taliban? Why were we supporting the Taliban? To tell you the truth, many Pakistanis, did not read my book before 9/11. People abroad read my book, and I was getting, good reviews abroad, but I wasn't particularly getting noticed in Pakistan. But thank God, after 9/11, many Pakistanis started reading my book. So the kind of critique that I have there of Pakistan's policy in Afghanistan, which has been devastating for Pakistan, because it's fueled militancy, it's fueled this radicalism, which we are now seeing in Pakistan, the kind of terrorism we are now seeing in Pakistan. So essentially, what I'm trying to say is, yes, the Muslim world needs to reform, and it needs Western pressure also. It needs a mixture of incentives and pressure. It needs aid. It needs aid to reform its educational system. Pakistan, Central Asia needs aid to reform the educational system. It needs pressure on Saudi Arabia to reform the kind of syllabuses where, these young kids are being taught that, everything Western is evil and every non-Muslim is an infidel, and cannot be talked to. So the educational system, the collapse of the state educational system in a country like Pakistan over the last 20 years has been a critical factor in creating this madrasa culture and creating this this culture of hate and intolerance, within the fold of Islam, which has nothing to do with the teachings of Islam. So again, what I'm trying to say here is simply that the American influence and American commitment to Afghanistan and Central Asia, to do the right thing in Afghanistan and Central Asia, is going to enhance American credibility in the rest of the Muslim world and enhance what many Muslim Democrats and liberals want, which are conditionalities, on and pressures and incentives on our regimes to do the right thing. Our track record of our regimes is that the regimes are not going to do the right thing until there's pressure, and until there's a mixture of pressure and incentives. you know, to do the right thing. So I think a commitment to Afghanistan, a commitment to, you know, doing the right thing in Afghanistan and Central Asia is vitally important to kind of raise that level of credibility. I think also, as I said, not only, you know, the Muslim regimes really need to start a debate about the need for some kind of reformation within the Islamic world, about the need to discuss issues of democratization, media freedom, you know, economic reforms, and basically delivering goods, you know, to the people. I mean, delivering benefits to the people. And that, you know, has started in varying degrees. I think, you know, in countries like Pakistan, where there's a tradition, a much bigger tradition of, you know, a free press and some democratic governments in the past, although we don't have one right now, you know, there's a real debate going on in the press, in within intellectuals, within business groups, within, you know, all kinds of organizations. In the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia, it's perhaps less. But it has started, and I think, you know, it's going to be a very slow process, but it has started. For example, there was this horrible incident in Saudi Arabia where these young girls were burned to death in a school. I don't know if you heard about that, because they were not wearing their veils, and the guards would not let them out of the burning school, you know. And for the first time, I mean, you know, there have been critical articles in the Saudi press criticizing these habits. So now, you know, I mean, things are not going to change overnight, but I think it's very important that this debate begins and takes off, and is done by Muslims. I mean, you know, and is done, you know, by leading figures in the Muslim world, you know, politicians and business people and, you know, all the rest of it. And I think, you know, the U.S. has to be a positive influence there. I mean, it does not have to sort of blame, you know, everyone, but it can be a very positive influence to encourage this. And therefore, it is incredibly important that the U.S. has a credibility to, you know, to do this in the Muslim world. And in my neck of the woods, that credibility is built up by doing the right thing in Afghanistan and in Central Asia and in Pakistan. Let me just end if I can, just 2 minutes, if I can give a plug to this this media foundation. Basically, you know, I put up a bunch of, you know, a whole part of my royalties to set up the development of a free and independent press in Afghanistan. I was in Kabul. We've just given our first grant of $15,000 to the Lower Jirga Commission, which is an independent body which has which will be publishing, you know, this grant will allow it to publish a newsletter in 4 Afghan languages, which will be distributed around the country by the United Nations to educate people about the Lower Jirga and the rules, regulations, how to elect people, etc. We're looking at, you know, dozens of proposals from Afghans for newspapers, women's magazines, children's magazines, and I hope, you know, basically the idea is that we want the Western media, media and foundations to, you know, and individuals to contribute to this, and it will not take money from Western governments, so that it remains, you know, free of kind of influence of Western governments. Let me say that, one example of the kind of things that are happening in Afghanistan is that while Operation Anaconda was going on, there was also the first program of a national unifying program in the country was this back to school. You know, 1.5 million children went back to school on one day. This was a program organized by UNICEF, supported by AID. It was an incredible operation. In 3 months, they printed 6 million textbooks. 50,000 teachers were given, you know, were mobilized. Schools were basically, at least the window panes were put back, even if there were no desks or blackboards or anything else. You know, packages of black, you know, exercise books and pencils were distributed. And 52,000 teachers went back to work, out of which about 40,000 were women. You know, there was no objection from the men, because for the first time, you know, these wives, housewives, were going to be going back to school teaching and bringing in an income. You know, and of course, you know, Afghanistan has a tradition where the education sector has largely been run by women. Even the boys' schools are run by women. You know, so this was going on while Al-Anaconda was going on. Now, I say to you, you know, why did this happen? It happened simply because Laura Bush was interested in education and told AID that this has to happen. You know, and AID put in $14 million into the publishing of these textbooks, which is done on a crash basis. So what I'm suggesting here is, you know, if the Americans are really interested in committing themselves to rebuilding, things will happen. And everyone will then become galvanized. The UN agencies, the European NGOs, I mean, things start happening. Now, what is needed in Afghanistan simply are more unifying projects like this. I mean, you cannot imagine. I mean, first of all, you know, for the first time in 7 years, mothers actually saying goodbye to their children in the morning and actually getting them out of the house and knowing that they were going to get a glass of milk and a lunch at school and that they were going to come back 5 hours later. Was itself an astonishing thing. Secondly, I mean, the fact that this was happening in, you know, the furthest tip of northern Afghanistan to the bottom tip of southern Afghanistan, this was happening on one day. I mean, just the simple act did more, in my opinion, to diminish the power of the warlords. Because the warlords have no economic agenda, they have no educational agenda. You know, this single thing, you know, it told these young soldiers, these young kids who are fighting for these warlords, look, I mean, we can go back to school and we can learn some new things maybe. So what is needed is more of these kinds of unifying, you know, actions in health, in education, and, you know, in all the other parts of governance and rebuilding the infrastructure. So I leave you, you know, with these thoughts, and I hope that there will be public pressure in the U.S. and policy pressure from all various, you know, departments of government, that, you know, the commitments of the U.S. remains, and that, you know, the public is involved, you know, through congressmen or through the media and through other means, through education and the universities, on maintaining pressure that, you know, the U.S. has to do right now by the Afghan people. Thank you very much indeed.
I've been asked to moderate. Ushers will be passing among you. Somebody's already read the book Jihad. That's great. I did too. In Jihad, you warn against the Central Asian government's repression of Muslim activism. In the 80s and 90s, Pakistan did the opposite and encouraged Islamic extremism. Can General Musharraf stop the militants without further eviscerating civil society in Pakistan? And can the Central Asian republics allow Islamic activism without being dominated by it?
Right. Well, you know, is this one?
Yeah. That's
one. Pakistan, General Musharraf now wants to have elections in October. The military is preparing for that. I cannot see a military regime being able to deal with this, with all the complexities of extremism in Pakistan on its own. It cannot be done by the military mindset. It needs a sharing of genuine power with civil society. It needs elections. It needs a civilian government. And, you know, if you want to reform the educational system, if you want to do all these civil society things, the military can't do it. And I think it's very important the military genuinely sets about deciding to share power with civil society through a free and fair election. Nobody, given the crisis in Pakistan right now, nobody is particularly advocating that, you know, the military, you know, has to completely take a back seat. They're going to insist upon certain a role in the power structure. But I think that, you know, given the crises around Pakistan, with India, Afghanistan, all this is going on, I think people will by and large accept that. But it can't be done by the military alone. And I think that's where Musharraf is failing. He's not reaching out to people. There needs to be a popular mandate to do what needs to be done. In Central Asia, I think it's going to be very difficult. But let me tell you, I mean, in Central Asia, there's also a very strong feeling within the elite, within the establishment, that this is also our golden moment of opportunity, and we can't mess it up. You know, we're back on the world stage, we've got the attention of the whole world, we've got the possibility of investment and opportunity and this and that. I hope the sensible politicians and leaders in Central Asia are going to be influenced by this thinking. That it's not just a question of the West putting pressure on them. For them also it's a golden opportunity. You know, they're not going to get this opportunity again. You know, that there's so much focus on the West in this part, you know, obscure part of the world which nobody even knows, you know, exists basically. So I think there are people in Central Asia who also realize the opportunities.
Okay, well, this is another tough question. I'm certainly glad you're answering them, not me. Why is the U.S. so much kinder to Pakistan than to Saudi Arabia? It seems like Pakistan's record is worse on terrorism than is Saudi Arabia's.
Well, good. You know, that's a tough one. You know. Well, you know, I think the U.S. has... Well, gosh. the U.S. I was going to say the U.S. has had a long relationship with Pakistan, but so it has with Saudi Arabia, you know. I think, you know, the military, you know, the whole military strategy is basically, you know, Pakistan has been critical to that, you know, in the last 5 months, you know, because of the bases, because of, you know, the whole operational thing that was going on from Pakistan, you know, it's been critical. And secondly, I think Pakistan is considered an incredibly fragile state right now. It could tilt, you know, and there was a danger in October, November, when there was huge demonstrations going on in Pakistan, that, you know, the fundamentalists really may have had the potential to launch a mass movement against the present regime. Pakistan remains very fragile, which is why I emphasize that I don't think the military alone can tackle the problems right now. You have the problems of, you know, ethnicity, fundamentalism, Kashmir and India on one side, you know, they're huge, enormous problems. And I think, you know, the US is possibly very scared of Pakistan's fragility. The Saudi regime probably is a bit more stable, despite the very severe problems in Saudi Arabia, and clearly Saudi Arabia needs to also carry out major reforms.
Okay. Are U.S. policies against Iraq hurting us in Central Asia, or do we need to remove Saddam Hussein for Middle East world security?
Do we need to remove
him? Do we need to remove him?
Yeah. Well, you know, let me just say that I think, you know, Saddam Hussein is not acceptable to anyone, and clearly the regime in Iraq is not acceptable to anyone. But at the same time, I think at the moment, given what the U.S. and what the rest of the world is involved with, this is not only the wrong time, but clearly the wrong moment to do something like this. I think, you know, the Middle East is in an explosive situation right now. An attack by the U.S., and it would be a unilateral attack, because any attack on the U.S. is not being supported by anyone else in the world. No Muslim country, no European country, not the Far East, not even Japan. I think, you know, it would create an explosive situation in the Muslim world, a unilateral attack by the U.S. on Iraq right now. Unfortunately, you know, how many people in the Muslim world saw this axis of evil speech of Bush's was, you know, this was an articulation of U.S. foreign policy. This was not an articulation of the global coalition against terrorism. You know, the U.S. wants to get rid of Saddam, it wants to get rid of the Iranian regime and the North Korean regime. You know, that's not the world's intention. Everybody went up in arms after that speech. You know, the Europeans, the Japanese, the Muslim world, simply because this was seen as something of an aberration from the coalition against terrorism, and something that could split the coalition against terrorism. which would be very dangerous. I mean, U.S. policy right now surely should be, given the international network of bin Laden around the world, given the fact that U.S. troops are now in the Philippines, in Yemen, in Georgia, what is needed now is a strengthening of the coalition against terrorism, strengthening the resolve of Muslim countries, of European countries, of other countries around the world to get involved and deal with Al-Qaeda cells and etc., you know, in their countries, and to cooperate, you know, with intelligence and all this kind of thing. But this whole axis of evil was seen as a kind of completely divisive issue, because it was dividing, you know, countries on so many issues, and creating a diversion. You know, the immediate target, I think, is to deal with Al-Qaeda and the threat of terrorism, you know, in America, in Europe, and other parts of the world.
Okay. Actually, I'm going to do a quick little plug for my own research, because I happen to agree with you. I think one of the most important concerns in the third world is the promotion of literacy, and essentially doing what we do, oddly enough, in the state of Washington, which is focusing on the K-12 system rather than the university system. And I think in much of the Middle East and South Asia, literacy rates are remarkably low, and tragically so. So what I was going to do is to read this question, which I thought was a great question. Do you have any suggestions for how the U.S. can be involved in further educational reform in Afghanistan, and especially without it being a form of cultural imperialism?
Well, you know, I think it's very clear that, I mean, in Afghanistan you're starting from scratch. But let me give you a small example of Pakistan. In these last 20 years, the state educational system in Pakistan, which was secular, which taught all the subjects, basically collapsed. And at the same time, you had the rise of the madrasas, the religious schools, which started teaching militancy, training, you know, militants. You have a million kids now probably in these madrasas, simply because, you know, as the state education system collapsed, the madrasas funded by donations, by religious parties, groups, etc., were able to provide kids with free food, free education, housing, etc. Now, the Musharraf government, you know, Musharraf came to Washington 3 weeks ago and asked the U.S. for $100 million to modernize the madrasa system. Every educationalist in Pakistan is opposed to that. What people wanted, you know, what all educationalists in Pakistan are saying, get international funding to rebuild the state education system and start a serious literacy campaign. Modernizing the, you know, what are you going to do? You know, the plan is to put a computer into the madrasas. I mean, what are you going to do by putting a computer into the madrasas? You know, they'll probably create websites and, you know, create many more, you know, spread militancy even more. What is needed, yes, is to control the madrasa system and let the madrasa system go back to what it was before, which was the madrasas are very much a part of Islamic culture and tradition, which is that they produced scholars and mullahs. You know, they produce the priesthood. I mean, you have, you know, Christianity as its, you know, priesthood schools, as it were. So let the madrasas go back to what they've been doing for 2,000 years. You know, they're not supposed to be part of the main education system. So, you know, there is this debate now going on in the whole, in countries like Pakistan and in the Middle East, that the madrasas have to go back to doing what they were. The state educational system has to be supported and funded to revamp and modernize itself. And I certainly hope that the U.S. will be, you know, providing support for this in Afghanistan. I think it's absolutely critical. Kids are desperate for education. I mean, I can't tell you. You know, I was in Kabul in December, and I went to see a friend of mine, and his wife came out, both his young daughters, who were like 6 and 7, in December, were walking around the house with the satchels on their back, saying, "When can we go back to school? You know, we're waiting to go back to school." I mean, the kids are just desperate to, you know, have a normal life. Families are desperate to have a normal life. I think there's an enormous amount the U.S. can do in promoting in education. And here you have, you know, you don't have any contradiction here, as you might in Pakistan. I mean, you have a population which is exhausted by war, fed up with war, and is desperate to get back to normalcy, of which education is so important.
Okay. If the Taliban are not following true Islam, then why are the mullahs and Muslim intellectuals not speaking out against the Taliban, is the question. And perhaps you might want to suggest, if there are in fact people speaking out against them who we're not hearing about in the United States.
Well, I make this point very strongly in my book, in the Taliban book, simply that, you know, I think the real tragedy for the Muslim world in the 90s and what I talked about earlier is the, you know, the lack of reform, and simply none of these Muslim regimes who were really even, some of them were even opposed to the Taliban, spoke out against them. And I think it was a huge political mistake. What else can I say? I mean, I think it has been hugely detrimental in these 7 years that even countries like Malaysia, countries like Indonesia, you know, countries with much more of, if you like, a secular tradition, countries which the Taliban were proving to be quite threatening to because they were housing their militants, did not speak out against the Taliban. Quite apart from the fact that there were many countries supporting the Taliban, you know, the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, etc. But I think that was hugely detrimental, and that, you know, that this complete misinterpretation of Islam and you know, what they were doing to human rights and to women and to everything, you know, that it was being raised in the West, it was not being raised in the Muslim world. I think that was very wrong.
Okay. I think we have time for a couple of more questions. Let me ask this one. How do you think that the new government of Afghanistan will handle the Indo-Pakistani conflict?
Well, you know, I think, to tell you the truth, in Afghanistan at the moment, there's enormous resentment against Pakistan because of the support that Pakistan gave to the Taliban. I think that will, you know, die down, in the months ahead. But I think, at the same time, the Afghan government will be very cautious and will not want to get involved. And it will try and keep a balance between India and Pakistan. The Indians, of course, are flooded into Afghanistan right now, are trying to give, you know, establish a real presence because, you know, of the conflict with Pakistan, and they're trying to exploit the new Afghan government and to make the Afghan government kind of more dependent on India than Pakistan. And that, it's a game that goes on, you know. But I think Hamid Karzai is eminently sensible. He visited Pakistan. He had a very good meeting with General Musharraf, and he went back and praised Pakistan's support and contribution to reconstruction and all the rest of it. So I think, you know, they're going to try and keep out of it and keep a balance between India and Pakistan.
Last question, which I think will end this, I'm hoping, on a somewhat positive note. How much confidence do you have in the ability of the various Afghani tribal political groups to create and maintain a central government? I suppose that's, what do you think about the future?
Well, you know, I'm basically optimistic because I think, you know, for many reasons. I mean, you have 99% of the people have had enough. I mean, they don't want warlordism, they want a proper government, they want a modern state, they want all the attributes of, you know, belonging to a society and a functioning society. Now, you know, I think the warlord's power is much diminished from what they were in the early 90s and the mid-90s. These warlords lack credibility. Many of them have been defeated by the Taliban, they've had to come back, and they don't have the influence and the clout that they had before. And I think if you can get some of the, you know, the aid in, the money in, the political process is moving, you will be chipping away at their power over time. I think the Lower Jirga process is going to be a hugely positive, invigorating. For the first time in 23 years, you will have, hopefully, a kind of legitimized political process. You know, I mean, don't forget, I mean, there has been no legitimate government for 23 years in this country. You know, so I think the international community, despite all what I may have said, you know, remains very conscious of the fact that they have to stay committed in some form or another to Afghanistan. So I think, you know, there's a, yes, it will be messy. You know, there will be, you know, Taliban, Al-Qaeda will be trying to do their thing, there will be terrorism, there will be, you know, ethnic clashes, there will be, you know, but this is Afghanistan after all. I mean, you don't come out of 23 years of war and have kind of instant peace. So it will be messy, but anyone, I think, with any kind of experience in Afghanistan will understand that basically you know, 99% of the people, you know, want peace and stability. And so I think it will happen. Can I just thank you all very much? It's been an enormous pleasure. Thank you very much.